I want to just show you a picture tonight as we begin. If you'll go ahead and bring that up there, Jeremy, appreciate it. I'm not sure how well you can see that, but it is. I'm going to look at this one since it's a better view than the back projector. But this was taken from Spruce Knob, which as you know, if you know West Virginia, is the highest point in our state. Up on the mountain there, many of you have driven that windy road up there at one point or other in your life. And I don't know who to attribute this to because it was unattributed from my source, but it was actually on a website from the Maryland Astronomical Society, which is a group of amateur astronomers. So they went up there on the mountain and took that picture. And if you can see right in the middle of the picture, you see what most of us are familiar with. If you have a dark enough sky and the moon is not in the sky, it's what we call the Milky Way. Especially in the summer, it's sort of right overhead and as far as its inclination to us. And I put that up there because basically when you read David's words, that was about all he could see. Now, he being in a day when you don't have bright lights and street lights and city lights that we contend with, if he had a moonless night, he had a very good view of the night sky, probably impressive. And frankly, most of us don't enjoy that too much. If you ever can get out camping or get away from it all, just look up and enjoy what you don't see living here in town too much. But that was all he could see. But based on what he could see, he says, "What I see tells me that the heavens declare, shout, that God is a glorious God." Now, you think about us here in 2016. We have access to information, and we can see, at least virtually, through instruments and photography and satellites and space probes and space telescopes, we can see vastly more than David ever did. And now, he obviously knew of the earth, but he never saw this picture of the earth that you and I are familiar with. You'll go ahead and flip the one there. I showed you this one a few weeks ago, but that's taken by the Discover satellite, and it is between the earth and the sun, permanently positioned there, pointing back at the earth, and takes this picture, and it captured this series of stills put into a video to show the moon passing in front of the earth. I find that a very fascinating point of view. So he knew about the earth. He also knew about the moon, which we see in the night sky. But you think about it, he never saw the moon even this good. I mean, he didn't have a pair of binoculars or a camera with a zoom lens or a telescope or a magazine. He didn't have National Geographic to flip to an article on the moon and see, wow, look at that. He just saw the moon and what you see, what you and I could see, with the naked eye. Yet, he says, the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. And we talked about the moon two sessions ago. Actually, it was on the night of the supermoon, so that worked out real well. So we talked about the lesser light, as it says in Genesis 1, to rule the night. Last time we were together, we talked about the greater light to rule the day. And here's an image of the sun that I showed you previously. And we see the sun in detail with all these instruments and all the different spectrums and that sort of thing. But you and I have never seen it that way with our naked eye. We just see the sun in the sky, but you've done it impressive. But I want to just tell you this, and this is a kind of a means of saying this. If David, with what limited perspective, says how glorious God is, how much more should we, who know and see things he never dreamed of seeing, should we not even be more impressed? Maybe we should just shout the words of Psalm 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord. I'm going to take you just on a real brief tour, okay, if I can. And Jeremy, you just follow along as best you can up there, all right? But I want to take just our neighbors. Let's talk about our neighbors. Let's talk about Mercury, first of all. As you see it there, obviously the closest planet to the sun, working from the sun outwards. It has a diameter of about 3,000 miles. It's about 35 million miles from the sun, but even at that distance, it is just sort of a scorched cinder, if you will, if you want to say it that way. It's the most heavily cratered planet. You can't see it real well in there, but, well, you can really on the right limb. You see, it's the most heavily cratered. You think of the moon having craters. It has even more coverage of craters. It turns on its axis. Now, the Earth that we live on turns on its axis once every 24 hours. The planet Mercury, it takes 59 days to accomplish that same turn. So on the side that is slowly turning in the sun's glare, it heats up to more than 600 degrees Fahrenheit on that side. And on the side that's slowly turning through the shadow, it cools off to a minimum of 274 degrees below, minus 274 degrees Fahrenheit, so 274 degrees below zero. I just don't have any inclination to go visit Mercury myself. That just does not sound good at all. Moving out, you have Venus. And Venus has an atmosphere. It is covered by a predominantly carbon dioxide atmosphere. And it does form sort of a greenhouse over it that heats it up. The average surface temperature of Venus is more than 800 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just, that's unbelievable to me. It's 67 million miles from the sun, about 7,000 miles in diameter. Now, you think that Mercury is slow to turn on its axis. Venus takes 243 days to make one turn on its axis. But it also then, it takes 224 days to go completely around its orbit of the sun. So think about this. It takes longer to make one revolution than it does to take its completely orbit, its year, if you will, around the sun. So everything you look in our near neighbors, it's diverse, it's different, it's surprising. If you assume the evolutionary theory that it just all sort of spun out of the same stuff, you'd expect everything to look alike, behave alike, randomly move alike. I should have told you the orbit of Mercury is actually, it takes it 88 days to go around the sun. So its year is only about 2 months long or slightly more. So traveling different. And then the place you know of closest there, actually, let's see what your picture looks like. Oh, Mars. Okay, I can keep this straight. Did I have a picture of the Earth up there? Oh, okay. That's Venus and the Earth in one picture. Okay. Just to show a size comparison. I remember why I put that there now. Venus is the closest in size to our Earth. And oftentimes it's described as our sister planet. I don't know about you, but they must have had different fathers and different mothers because it doesn't look anything alike. And I'm going to make a point about that in just a bit. But you see creativity, you see variety, you see even in the colors. It's as if God just kind of gets out all of his paints and puts them all over his board and starts painting the canvas. And he's not content just to make cookie cutter things, but everything is unique. Well, the Earth, as you know, because we live there, is 92 million miles away. It turns on its axis 24 hours. Takes 365 and a quarter days to go around the sun and so forth. Interestingly, because it is placed where God placed it, in a zone that's not too close to the sun where it's really hot or further away from the sun where it's really cold, the average temperature worldwide, and I understand it goes up and down, varies, but the average temperature worldwide is 59 degrees. A lot different than if you lived on Venus or if you lived on Mars. Now we'll go to Mars. Is Mars coming up there? Okay. Mars, of course, is further out. It's 141 million miles from the sun. Interestingly, it has almost the same day we do. It takes 24 hours and 37 minutes for it to make one turn on its axis. So its days would be very similar to Earth. But it takes 667 days to make one revolution, one orbit around the sun. So its year is twice as long as ours. Its surface temperature varies. The minimum surface temperature is 207 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, so very, very cold. And its highest surface temperature is only 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So you already see things are cooling down as we go out. Then we come to the planets that we know as the gas giants because they are large giants and because their surface, rather than being hard surface, is a gaseous surface, and Jupiter is next in line, okay? And you can see the famous red spot there that you can see. You can actually see the red spot with a moderate telescope, so it's because it's so vast. It's very bright in the sky. Right now, if you got up, I wouldn't recommend it tomorrow because it's probably going to be raining, at least based on what it looks like out there now. But if you get up before dawn and the sun is not over the horizon, you look to the east to see a real bright star, you're looking at Jupiter, all right? By the way, if you look in the western sky right now, right after dark, right after the sun goes down, very bright star, that's Venus, just in case you're wondering. It is 88,000 miles in diameter, 483 million miles from the sun. It has 63 moons. You think about it. We have one moon. Mars has two. Venus and Jupiter, Venus and Mercury have none. But it has 63 moons that we have discovered, and some have been found even fairly recently, so there might be more going around it. It turns on its axis very fast. Every 9 hours and 55 minutes, it's made one revolution. And to go around the sun, it takes it slightly under 12 years, to make one orbit around this top. And interesting, the top of the clouds, which is the surface we see, the average temperature is minus 234 degrees below zero. Very, very cold. And then our favorite planet, at least it's my favorite planet. You can have your own favorite planet, I guess, but you just got to love Saturn with its ring system that goes around it. It's just awe-inspiring to see it. 1.4 million miles from the sun. It has 60 moons that circle it. It turns on its axis every 10 hours, and it takes it almost 30 years, or 30 Earth years, to make one revolution around. And its rings are its most striking feature, made up, from what we understand, of dust and ice. Interestingly, very shortly, there's been a satellite, or a space probe would be better terminology, going around Saturn called the Cassini. And they're now maneuvering it so it's going to go very, very close to the rings and get a close-up view of the rings here in the next period of time. So if you get National Geographic, you can find that article, okay? Next out is Uranus, 2.8 million miles from the sun. 27 moons go around it, turns on its axis every 17 hours. One orbit, 1 year on Uranus would take 84 Earth years. Surface temperature, 210 degrees. Actually, that's Celsius. I'd have to convert that. I didn't do that. And then Neptune, again, a gas giant, 4.4 million miles from the sun, 16 hours to rotate. Takes 165 years to make one orbit of the sun. And then, of course, what is no longer a planet, but you have Pluto, because the Astronomical Union about 2 or 3 years ago demoted it to a dwarf planet. It's no longer a planet. I don't like that because I think it's a cool place, so it shouldn't be called a planet. That's my opinion, but no one asked me. But it is. We talked about this in detail, and it was just visited by its first probe in 2015. One orbit around the sun takes 248 years. So you think how big a circle it goes all the way around. And, of course, its most notable feature, you can see it there in the lower right, not real clear in that picture, but it's sort of a heart-shaped sort of plane. And so when the first pictures come in, people were all excited that it had a big heart on it for that sort of thing. But you think about all the things that we see, and I've shown you a few other pictures as well as we've gone forward just to kind of help us get some appreciation. I showed you this picture before. It's called the Pillars of Creation, which is a vast cloud of hydrogen gas lit by accompanying stars. It's called the Eagle Nebula, or M16. Beautiful picture. Probably the most famous picture that's been taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And I could just look at that for a long time. And then the Andromeda Galaxy. You just get further and further. We talked about this, it's huge. It's vast. So all of the above, when David sat down to put pen to parchment, when he writes Psalm 19, he never saw any of that. You and I would be very remiss with the information and the access to creation God has given us not to say even louder, in life and in actions, the heavens declare the glory of God. And as it says, and the firmament shows his handiwork. I just want to spend a little time tonight looking at what I've just entitled some lessons from above. We're going to look at two of David's writings, the first one right here in Psalm 19. Then we're going to skip back to Psalm 8 for just a little bit. And we're just going to think along with him what lessons we can learn that he used the same information, only much less, that he had access to help us just get some appreciation for who God is. So we're going to start tonight with Psalm 19, these first 6 verses. And in this, I think you just see that the heavens shout a message to us. The heavens shout in Psalm 19, verses 1 through 6. And by the way, thank you for putting that up there. That's been kind of our theme artwork and verse. But again, in front of the Milky Way, the heavens declare its handiwork. Okay, you can go to the next slide, please. Thank you. The heavens shout. The heavens declare, and literally that's what it means. It shouts. It's sort of like a proclamation made by a king or someone announcing some significant event. Back in David's time, you didn't have newspapers or television or Twitter to announce stuff. You had to actually have someone with a voice to shout it out. So he says, the heavens shout out. What does it shout out? The fact that God is glorious. He is singular, one of a kind, impressive. In every way, by every calculation, by every nuance of appreciation, God is an absolutely marvelous God. So when David looked up what limited he could see, he says, Lord, it's shouting to me that you are a glorious God. And it says the firmament, which is, we would say, I think the best modern equivalent of the term firmament is space. It really, literally in Hebrew, the word that's translated firmament, both here and in Genesis, it literally means a stretched out thinness. Well, that's not real helpful. But a stretched out thinness, sort of like a canopy stretched out above you, like a tent covering. But it, so he's talking about everything that's this canopy that covers us. So space, if you will, and all of a sudden. It shows, first of all, it shows his handiwork. What does the heavens shout to us? First of all, it shouts to us about God's ability. About God's ability. If you take a literal reading of Genesis chapter 1, which I do, and I hope you do as well, because God is the glorious, majestic, great God that He is, the Scriptures declare that in 6 days, God spoke into existence everything that you and I have ever experienced, seen, or know about, and more of creation than we probably do know about. But He created it because He spoke it into existence. And on day four of creation, the Lord God, remember we looked at this several times, it says he made the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, the sun and the moon. And then at the end of that little section, he says, and he made the stars also. All the rest of it, he just spoke it into existence. The fact that God not only speaks it into existence, but the marvelous nature of his creation just speaks about the significance of God, his handiwork, his artistry. That's one of the reasons I showed you several of those pictures. I wanted you just to see a little bit of the artistry of God, the beauty of God. Now, I told you in 2015, the New Horizons spacecraft, and we talked about this in our first session, made a flyby of Pluto and took the first close-up pictures of it. Well, the scientists did not have any real idea, because it's so far away, what they were going to see in these pictures. And based on what the rest of the solar system was like, they had these ideas about what Pluto was going to be like. And there's a guy by the name of Alan Stern. Alan Stern was the head of this whole project and still is. But I remember reading some things by Alan Stern, and basically he tweeted, he says, everything we're seeing about Pluto is turning everything we thought about Pluto on its head. Because nothing about it seemed to match. And one of the things, isn't this interesting, okay? These are people who believe that the universe is billions of years old, and they throw those numbers around and believe in a cosmic scheme of evolution. One of the things they found was the surface and some of the it has a very thin atmosphere. And they believe, because of its low gravity, that part of this atmosphere is just kind of escaping out into space. And if Pluto was as old as evolutionary science says it is, there should be no atmosphere left. It should all be gone. But lo and behold, they get to Pluto and they find out it has a little bit of very thin atmosphere. Of course, the scientists, rather than saying, well, maybe it's younger than we thought it was, they're still doing this. We're scratching our heads. There must be some mechanism keeping replenishing the atmosphere that we don't understand yet. You know, interesting for us and good for us to remind ourselves is if you block yourself into a way of thinking, you will even take clear facts to the opposite to mean different than they are because it doesn't fit your frame of reference. And we start with a prejudiced frame of reference as Christians. It's called the Bible. I would much rather start with a prejudiced frame of reference based on what God has told us than what we can figure out with our little minds. So let's say that as well. But it's his handiwork. Even the planets we've visited, it's cause for awe that we didn't expect that. That's amazing. It shows his handiwork. And it also shows his ability, the ability of a God that God invites us to trust him. He invites us to trust him in the ups and the downs, the twists and the turns, the scary and the mundane parts of life. God is able. God is able. God is able to meet our needs. And obviously, what he does is in accordance with his will. We pray for healing. God is able to heal in a moment. Now, we have to accept his will that it's not his will, even though we pray in faith that everybody is healed. There's a different plan for everybody and how that works out. But he is able. Secondly, he says in verse 2, day unto day utters speech. I like how he says day unto day. Every day, the sun coming up and the sun going down and the stars coming out and the phases of the moon. That's what he could have seen. You and I know so much more about the mechanisms of all of this. He says, it utters speech. It's saying something. It's communicating something. It's shouting in verse 1. It's completely going with a dialogue, if you will. It's a way of saying there's a running commentary on God weaved into all of the ongoing display of time and creation. And night unto night, that last two words is important, it reveals knowledge. This is one of the lessons from above. God has an infinite ability, and God has infinite knowledge. By the way, if you think about it, that's all that we need to trust in God. I mean, you think about it. Let's say you have to have surgery, okay? And it's very serious, life or death, okay? And you go to a surgeon. Would you want him to have extreme ability but limited knowledge, or would you rather have him to have extreme knowledge and limited ability when he does surgery on you? You don't want either or, do you? You want both and. You want someone with a great amount of knowledge and a great amount of ability, because both of those are necessary for you to have a good outcome if you have to have some serious work done. When it comes to the serious work that God does, he has infinite knowledge and infinite ability. Those two things work in harmony for our good. And you could add one more part to the triangle, which David doesn't talk about, but if you don't mind, I'll do it. We also have a God who has a perfect nature and a compassionate heart. When you have knowledge, ability, and a good nature, that's the kind of God you and I want, and fortunately, that's the kind of God you and I have. That we can trust in. So he has knowledge. Do you ever think about how little you and I know? Now, I read you all those facts and figures about the planets, okay? And I've studied astronomy and I've read books. I still had to go look it all up again tonight, in preparation for tonight. And I also had 6 pages of notes in front of me, so I'd hopefully get it right. We can't contain all the knowledge we've even processed in our brain. We can't get it out. We can't recall it. We need help. We need other data methodologies to help us remember. But you know what? All the facts and the figures and the future and how it all works, God has never had to go to a book or an encyclopedia or any sort of database to ever look anything up. You think about it, whatever your profession is, whatever it is, whether it's the recipe to make the stuffing for the turkey on Thanksgiving, or it's some detailed formula you use in your work, or some legality you have to meet in your work, we're always referring to the data, to the database. What are the ingredients? What is the law? What is the formula? God has never, ever had to refer to anything other than himself to know everything there is to know. And we who are of such limited knowledge have the right and the access. James chapter 1, if anyone lacks wisdom, do what? Ask of God, who gives to all men liberally. We are blessed by the knowledge of God. Thirdly, verse 3, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is going out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And in them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run the race. Its rising is from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hid from its heat. So he completes this little poetic portion of a hymn, about the sun and its moon and its movements, I should say. But notice he says, this line is going out, their words have stretched everywhere. And he talks about the sun from the horizon to horizon, in other words, and he says, there's this voice of God going out. So we'll add that to the list. The heavens shout. What do they shout? They shout God's ability. They shout about God's knowledge. And the heavens shout about God's voice, the message he wants to get through to us. Now, why is that important? There is one problem that is difficult for us. And if it's not been difficult, you probably haven't thought much about it. I think if you think much about it, it is a problem for us. For we understand that there's one way to be made right with God, and that's through Jesus Christ. That's what we believe. That's what the Scriptures teach. It is a wide open way to all who will receive, but there's only one exclusive way to the Father. And we worry, it troubles us. I wouldn't say worry. It troubles us about, what about somebody who's never heard? They've never had the chance to accept or reject Christ. They've never heard this message. And I am not going to answer that question in total, but and I just want to read a verse. You can turn there if you want, or just wait, whichever you want to do, because we're going back to Psalms very quickly. But in Romans chapter 1, Paul addresses the decadence and the decay of mankind in sin. It's basically, he starts with an indictment about man's sin. And I just want to read a couple verses, and this is where it intersects with this voice of God going out, all right? I'm reading Romans 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Verse 19. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. So what Paul's saying is, in some way, God has revealed himself to everyone. Verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, that's including the gospel, are clearly seen, having been understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. That's exactly what David is talking about in Psalm 19, this line, this voice going out everywhere. There is a witness that there is a God, there is a creator God, there is a good God. Now, we may not know everything that the Bible would reveal specifically about God, but everyone has access to that information if they will just open their eyes and open their hearts to look around. And that's the reason he says everybody's without excuse, because we should know some very basic things. You know, what you wear, what you own, what you touch, the seats you're sitting in, the shoes you're wearing, everything, the watch on your wrist if you have one, the phone you have in your pocket. We understand that all of that had to have a maker, someone, some factory, some place, some craftsman, some technician made that thing. We would say that chair, of course someone made it. It didn't just happen without any involvement of man. Someone designed it, made it, shipped it, put it there, and paid for it, and that was us, okay? So we understand how that works. So as we look around creation, we should hear his voice saying, someone had to make that. Someone had to make the sun and the moon and the stars and all the everything on this planet. And the fact that God made it means there's a creator. That means there's someone higher than us. And he must have made us as well. Therefore, we're responsible to him. So when he talks in Psalm 19 about this voice going out all over, that's a massive statement he's making that leaves us before him. So where does that leave us? I'm going to just show a couple ideas with you right now. First of all, we should know how much we need a connection to God. Notice how David does this. Wow, the heavens declare the glory of God. You know, the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day, it's telling me about knowledge. You know, night unto night, that's going on. His voice is being heard. Everything he saw brought him back to, okay, that connects me back to God. That reminds me of my need for God. It reminds me of the place of God. It reminds me to lift my voice and worship God. It reminds me in my heart to renew my trust in God. So our connection. And I don't know what you enjoy of creation. There's different people. There might be some of you that loves a nice, beautiful snowfall. If it would snow everywhere but the roads and the sidewalks, I would love it a lot more. But you know, it is beautiful. It is beautiful. The current issue of the West Virginia magazine just came out, and I forget the photographer's name to give credit, but it's taken these close-up pictures of individual snowflakes. And if you haven't seen it, go to the library or get a copy. But they're just absolutely gorgeous. Just, you know, how long is a snowflake going to last? I mean, not long. But they say that every snowflake is unique, which that blows my mind as well when you think of, you know, how many snowflakes is there in an inch of snow? I mean, a lot. More than we can calculate. So maybe you enjoy going to the beach and watching the waves just and getting sand in your shoes. Maybe that's what you like. Maybe you have a bird feeder and you like to watch the birds come and beg off of you. And if you put out the feed, they'll come and beg off of you. They'll do it. Maybe you got a dog or cat that fascinates you, or maybe you got a tank full of fish, or you just you enjoy whatever you enjoy about this. You like plants. You like gardening. Whatever it is, as you experience this creation, God wants us to come back and say, this connects me to Him. So here's two things. First of all, avoid the too busy in life. Oh, I just got to mow the grass, and I got to cut down the roses, and I got to rake the leaves, and I got to feed the dog and fill the bird feeder, you know, whatever it is. We just get so busy with our routine, we miss the wonder. We miss the wonder of it. I don't know if you can get too busy at the beach or not. I'm not much of a beach person. Some of you beach people can tell me, a lot of people tell me just going to the beach just sort of, you know, just kind of pulls all the tension out of you, and I have no stress. I don't know if that's true or not, but what? Maybe for you it's climbing a mountain or hiking on a trail or riding your bike or whatever it is. But we need to slow down and just look around and enjoy the beauty that's around us. To stop and look. To stop and look at the marvelousness of what He made. This past summer, two or three times, a spider, I never saw the spider, but I saw the web, built this web from like a little bush on our right outside our porch all the way up to a holly tree. I mean, it's probably 20 feet in span. And one of the spans of the spider web spanned the whole thing. I, for the life of me, cannot figure out how did that spider span 20 feet of space, and it's, you know, it can't be too big. I hope it's not too big a spider. But I remember going out there early in the morning when there's a little bit of dew on the spider web, just sitting there like, you know, if I could, I was almost tempted to get up in the middle of the night to see if I could see what was going on. I didn't actually do that, but it's amazing. I don't have any clue how it did that. Maybe a whole army of spiders comes in the night with scaffolding and puts it up. I don't know. I don't think so. But just look. Don't be too busy to enjoy creation. Secondly, allow time just to listen. Most of us are, and I plead guilty, and you're not going to be surprised what I'm about to say. I talk more than I listen. You know, I'm a professional talker on some level. But just to listen, meditate, think about what God's saying. Look at that spider web and say, Lord, what's that say about you? You know, that spider never went to school. It never had any engineering drawings. It never studied materials and processes. It never tried to pass algebra in high school. But somehow it knows innately. And you somehow programmed into that. How big can a spider brain be anyway? You somehow programmed into that creature the ability to do something that we marvel at. So just think and listen and slow down. And I'm enormously bad at what I'm telling you to do, okay? So I'm trying to remind myself to slow down and listen. So we should know how much, and everything should just be about this connection to God. Get to do something about the too busy and try to work on the time to listen. Turn, if you will, back to Psalm 8. And just a couple things from Psalm 8. That's going to, I think, just kind of help us in the same vein, the same venue. In verse 3 of Psalm 8, he goes on another little poetic, hymnotic journey through his mind and his thinking, and he says this. He's meditating as well. And there must have been something about shepherds. They must have had some time on their hands just to slow down and think and meditate. And he thought about his connection to God. He says, verse 3, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained. He made them. God put them in place. God arranged it all. And remember, he knew, he saw or could see far less than we see, at least by pictures. So then he asks the question. So when I see all that, I'm come to a question. What is man that you are mindful of him? Why do you even notice him? You think about it, you know, if you get in an airplane and you're flying on an airliner and you're, you know, 35,000 feet, what are you, 6-7 miles up above? I mean, that's not far, really far, very high. And you look down, you might see a road, you might see some cars on it, but everything, even just a little short distance, has grown pretty small out your window. If you went to the moon, a mere 250,000 miles away, the nearest place you could go that you could set down on solid ground, and you look back at the Earth, you wouldn't, and if you didn't know, you wouldn't know if there's any people on it or not. You wouldn't know if there's anything on it or not. You could see continents, and you could see clouds, and you could see solid Earth and water, obviously, and see the polar caps, but even at that distance, we just vanish into the vastness. And then you pull back of how big we try to perceive even our solar system or our galaxy, or, you know, and the numbers just become so ridiculously huge from our ability to calculate that we're just left like, wow. So David says, what is man that you even notice him? You see, this is what he's talking about here. Here's what the heavens show, okay? We talked about what they shout, but here's what they show. They show, first of all, man's smallness. They're designed to make us feel small because in actuality, we are enormously small. So small that why do you even notice? Why do you pick us out on this little tiny insignificant, from our point of view, David didn't have all this in his mind, but this little dot floating through the vastness of this vast region of space. I turned on the television the other day while I was getting ready to go somewhere, and I was going to try to hear a little news while I was getting ready for work, and I couldn't remember. I'm really bad at remembering the numbers of, you know, on the channel lineup, so I'm clicking around and. It clicks around to, is it Discovery Channel, History Channel? The one that has that ridiculous show called Ancient Aliens. And so it come on. I thought, okay, I'm going to give it 2 minutes just for a laugh, if nothing else, okay? But they were talking about, until the guy with the big hair comes on, then I got to turn it off. He's like weirdo. I've only seen a couple episodes, but so I don't watch it all the time. But anyway, they were talking about that some star way out there that they think the data indicates that it has a planet going around it. Because, you know, the stars are so far away. And scientists are so excited. See, there's all these planets out. Well, we've seen one, maybe. But the extrapolation is. And then of course, the talking heads start showing up on the TV saying, well, space is so vast. I just have to believe that it's teeming with life. That there's just all sorts of life out there. Well, first of all, you have to understand that's based on. Most of those people are basing that on an evolutionary construct. And the thinking is, if life just spontaneously generated on Earth, if the conditions were right, life just spontaneously generated on Earth, all you have to do is have the same conditions somewhere else, and what's going to happen? Well, life will spontaneously generate there. Because if it works here, it'll work there. But the Bible says God created the heavens and the earth, and he scooped together a handful of dirt. He spoke the animals into existence, scoops together a handful of dirt, and makes Adam, and takes a portion of his side, and makes Eve, and here we are. So, but that question sometimes asks, why would God make all of that if there's only us? I think perhaps one of the answers is so that no matter how we try to calculate, no matter how we try to perceive, no matter what we observe, that we're reminded we are really small. And that puts us in our place because we have a tendency as humans to think that we're really important and to think that we're really big stuff. So the smallness of man. He says this in this next verse. Or the end of verse 4, I should say. And the Son of Man that you visit him. You see, he talks about the heavens show man's smallness and it shows that man has had a visitor. Man's visitor is God himself. God did not just create us and then leave us alone. You know, drop us into the aquarium and just let us swim around and fend for ourselves. No, God interacts with his creation. He came walking in the cool of the day to have fellowship with Adam and Eve until they had disobeyed. He came down and met Abraham and talked to him. He talked to Moses on Mount Sinai. And on it goes. And then until we talked about it this morning, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. God has visited us. And David finds that just mind-blowing. And then he says this. For you have made him, speaking of that man that he doesn't know why he's mindful of him, that God has visited. You've made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. Now that seems like a contradiction. He's made lower than the angels, but he's also given glory and honor. Well, the glory and honor I'll talk about in a moment, but there is an angelic realm, an unseen realm. And we are at this point anyway, we are a little lower than the angels. In our ultimate redemption, Paul talks about it this way, do you not know that you will judge angels? So there's going to be a reordering of the order, but that's the way it is. But what is the glory and the honor? Verse 6, you have made him to have dominion over the work of your hands and to put all things under his feet. That takes you right back to Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. It talks about man's place, a little lower than the angels. It talks about man's purpose to be the superintendent of this world. Okay, verse 7, all sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the sea. And then he ends it as he began this same verse, the same psalm, I should say. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. So the heavens show that man is very small compared to God's, compared to creation even. But even in his smallness, God has come and visited us. And God has given us a place in this order that he's created. And in that place, he's given us a purpose. We haven't done real well with that purpose. But that's our ultimate purpose. And he gave us a place of significance. But David does the same thing he does in Psalm 19. He looks around and he says, this teaches me something about my connection to God. You and I need to look around and learn something about our connection to God. So here's what we need. We should know how much we need this connection to God. I've already given you that statement before, but let me just give you a couple things to think about. Number one, don't think too lowly. Think not too lowly of ourselves. Sometimes we just think we're just you know, people are unimportant, and our culture devalues people, whether that's, you know, devalues people in the womb or people in the end of life or people who have disabilities. I mean, it's a vicious world in the thinking of many people that leave God out of the equation, that believe that everybody is created in the image of God and has value just because they are a creation of God. That's why they have value. It's not what they can contribute or what their abilities are, or their disabilities are, or their age or their vulnerability. They're people. That's the divine work of God. We treat it with respect all the way through. Don't think too low, and also don't think too highly. Don't think too highly. We have a problem with pride. Jesus said it this way. It was the condemnation of the devil. It's what got the devil into the situation that he fell. And it's something that we struggle with. We think we are so smart. And we think that we can solve every problem. And every time we go to solve a problem, do you ever notice this? Just study history. Every time we try to solve a problem, we create about 10 more. When we leave God out of the picture, we do. So find somewhere this zone that balances. We are created by God, and we're given purpose, and we're crowned with glory and honor. But also, we are small. What is man that you're mindful of him? I find in Psalm 19 that David hits that zone. Well, I don't understand, Lord, why you could even see us. I don't understand why you visited us. But you placed us in a place, and you've crowned us with glory and honor. He has both in about three sentences there. And somehow we need to have that balance in our lives. We're not unimportant, but neither are we all important. God is that one that we make that connection back to.